Well, with the days getting shorter and the nights getting a lot colder, big temptation to hunker down in the house. And as it turns out, insects may be doing the same thing in your home as well. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Phil Pelletieri, extension entomologist, heads up the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, back for another visit. And Phil, great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
We have... always have lots to talk about, even when it's even when the weather's kind of crappy and cold. I think the thing that we can most maybe most likely talk about are all those insects that want to come inside into our homes.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting contrast to last year when the box elder bugs were so bad and the like. And this year, it really is, from my perspective, been very quiet. The Asian lady beetle did make a little bit of a comeback in the far northern part of the state about 3-4 weeks ago after the first cold weather up there. People were complaining about them trying to get in. But in the southern part of the state, you know, the trigger is usually a frost and then, you know, beautiful days after that. And it just seems when it finally decided to get cold here, it hasn't warmed up enough. And I have had no indication of problem with Asian lady beetles in the southern two-thirds of the state, and which has been kind of the pattern we've seen for quite some time. So, In comparison to last year, it was far more buggy with fall invaders than it has been this year, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Are there any that come in that are cause for concern, and is there anything we can do to dissuade insects from coming in?
Well, nothing that's going to bite, nothing's going to breed in the house, nothing's going to damage anything per se. It's just the nuisance and, you know, people's tolerance of insects. And the old argument is if you can solve the riddle how they're getting in by structurally caulking, sealing, or whatnot, you're done with this and you don't have to deal with it again. The problem so often when I get the calls is the insects have already migrated into the walls and whatnot, and it really kind of too late. I mean, there's no magic sprays that will penetrate walls. There are some things that can be done on the outside of structures that can't be sealed up, but those usually have to be done in September or at the very latest, the first week or so of October. So we're past that point now. So, but as I said, you know, with a little tolerance, understanding, they're really not hurting anything, and you're not going to have anything other than occasionally at breakfast a box elder bug will show up. And you know, I can understand that's unsettling, but the good news is it won't hurt anything.
And are there creative, I guess a creative way that an insect can get in maybe is on a hitchhike on a Christmas tree.
Well, what I see in Christmas trees is a little interesting. A few years ago, there was this urban legend that deer ticks overwintered on Christmas trees and you could bring ticks in your house. And there is just no science to support that. What I do see on occasion, there are especially some bark aphids, big, large for aphids, black creatures that can be found in the very late fall. And depending when the Christmas tree is cut, you know, they would be normally dormant at cold temperatures, but once you warm up, so people get all these little gnatty-like things and things crawling on the needles. Now, again, they're pretty short-lived indoors. If you had to kill them, a little soapy water is all you have to do. I don't think it's worth throwing the Christmas tree out for, but that is the only thing I think I've ever seen in my career that has been associated with Christmas trees is occasionally one of these aphid problems. And as I said, it's just something that you can easily take care of. You could probably just do it with a vacuum cleaner, too, if you wanted to. But soapy water kills them very easily. You know, don't have to use anything more toxic than that. And it won't go on for more than 4 or 5 days at best, typically.
Yeah. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. You can join in with your questions or comments, or maybe you've got an insect you want Phil to try and identify. If so, go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post your photo and question there. Or call us right now at 1-800-642-1234. Lynn in Oregon online. So let's go to Lynn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. I have a question about a centipede, and I know that's not an insect.
Mm-hmm.
For all the 30 years we've lived in this house, I have managed to keep a centipede in our bathroom. And very often the animal gets to about 3 inches long. You're beautiful and feathery. They like to sleep on the back of a towel. So you have to be kind of careful taking a towel off the rack. But their very size and the fact that they grow so fast makes me aware of how many insects they're eating. I know that they're predators, carnivores. And I'm wondering, how long do they live? How big can they get?
Mm-hmm.
What do they eat exactly? And how many offspring do they have? Because I always see if one gets killed by my cats, and I'm sorry about that. One little one always shows up, never a horde.
Right. No, and that's typical. Now, so first of all, I'll say that you are one of the amazing 1% of the people in the world that like or at least tolerate centipedes, because most people just absolutely can't stand them. And I think it's that creepy behavior. You turn the light on and you see this thing just go scurrying away. The species that we have indoors here is a tropical species. I've seen it referred to as a house centipede. The genus is Scutigera, but you don't find it outside. And what's characteristic is those very long feathery legs. Our native centipedes tend to be not quite as ornate. Relatively slow to breed. I would think you could expect them to live up to a couple years. Offspring, I don't know for a fact, but it has to be low. I think because it's not an ideal habitat, they're somewhat limited just because of food. So they eat sow bugs and ants and spiders, and I'm sure they eat other centipedes. There's no reason not to believe they're not cannibalistic, but I think it's kind of slim pickings. Now, they're nighttime hunter critters, so they're running around. And, you know, one of the interesting conversations I have with people when they have problems is that, you know, they can be living in wall voids and attic spaces you have no access to. So if some place has a lot of centipedes, just as you mentioned, there must be quite a bit of food around, and that's what you try to address is to, you know, stop the sow bugs from migrating in and other things that they might be feeding on. But other than that, technically they could bite you if you picked one up. I dare you to catch it. Yeah. I mean, they're just so quick and good at scurrying things that I don't worry about that. They're definitely not going to go out of their way to bite you. I said they're just kind of creepy, but full-grown house centipedes will probably get almost 3.5 inches long, so you're getting close to the max. The bathroom is an interesting place because people often see them there because they fall into the sink or the tub and they can't crawl out. So it gives you the appearance they're associated with moisture, and they really aren't. The more clutter in a house, potentially the more little critters that can hide under boxes, and the happier the centipedes are. But that's not a direct correlation, but there is some relationship there. So as I said, something that if people do have them, it's kind of an occasional one, but yeah. Constant. You'll see it slow down a little bit in the winter because of the cooler temperatures, maybe pick up when it starts to warm up in the spring. But that's kind of the extent of it.
There you go.
I've never been bitten, and I've helped a few out of the bathtub.
Yeah, no, I think you would have to.
And I put them on the floor, and then they head for a crack.
Yeah, no, I think you'd have to have them totally confined. You know, one in your bedroom slipper, and you put your foot in, type of thing. I mean, yeah. They said it's not their nature to be aggressive, but I can't rule out that they do have the capacity. If mishandled, might be a way of putting it, that you could get bit.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in as well. The number to call 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Have you seen anything particularly interesting in the lab recently?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, the interesting thing from my perspective, last year I was mumbling so much about how I'd set records, and it all made sense with the weather patterns and whatnot. I will set a new record this year, and I can't put my finger on why it seems so buggy, because it really doesn't, but it's just been kind of constant. In particular, there's no huge new invasive insect that's caught our attention. The spotted wing fruit fly in raspberries had a real good year, unfortunately, and now we're convinced that little stinker is here to stay. The marmorated stink bug has been very quiet. That should be invading people's houses right now. And other than a couple specimens I saw in the Dane County area, I have not seen any come in. So as I said, it's been unique in that standpoint. Was not a good year for butterflies. So there's some things that, and we're still paying for the droughts of last year. I mean, yeah. When we see what's happened, I guess that's the explanation for a lot of things that we saw, is that the weather patterns did get things out of sync, and it's going to take some time to get back to be more natural.
Jim in Green Bay has a question for you. Let's go to Jim. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. We have a cabin in northeast Wisconsin, and over the last 7 or 8 years, we've seen a tremendous increase in the deer tick population. I'm a bird hunter, and so I'm mostly up there in the fall. And this fall has been particularly bad, and I have two neighbors up there who, in fact, have gotten Lyme disease real close to us, but they got it during the summertime, not during the fall. And oddly enough, I didn't see hardly any deer ticks during the summer, but then about a month and a half ago or so, I started seeing a lot, and mostly they're the poppy seed size with the red and black, but occasionally I'll get a tiny little black one that's almost impossible to see.
Yeah, so that's the difference between boys and girls, to be honest.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. There's a couple phenomena going on here. In the summer, when most people acquire Lyme disease, at least human cases, it's the immature stage called the nymph, which is a smaller stage. And it's small enough that it's overlooked. That's why it's not pulled off a person. You're more likely to get sick. About the 15th of October, and this year I would say a couple weeks early in my observations, we start getting the new adults. And they show up and will stay here till there is snow on the ground. So they're out there right now, although maybe a little chilly. But if we get a warm 45-degree day, they're up and running. And the best people in the world to collect them are grouse hunters, because the habitat that you are in, the thickets and stuff where the birds are hiding, is where the ticks will be the happiest to be present. And so there is quite a relationship. And, of course, if you got a dog, the dogs are like a tick magnet when they're running through that stuff. And whereas pheasant hunters that are sitting out, you know, in more grasslands and whatnot, they really don't run into them. It's a very interesting phenomena. And so I had done a piece with Pat Durkin about a little over a week ago, because he was making that same comment that the people in the northeast part of the state are really saying the tick numbers are high. You know, and one of the interesting things that we've seen in research that my colleague Susan Paskowitz has done, you know, traditionally after a heavy drought, we find it takes the tick populations way down. We have not seen that relationship at all this year. In fact, if anything, we already saw the tick starting to rebound late last year, and so that's part of what's going on. But we're still a little bit perplexed, because they have a 2-year life cycle, so weather patterns don't, you know, they can't respond real quickly to things as much. So I definitely have enough reports that the northeast part of the state has more activity than we'd expect normally, and that may be the norm now. There's no reason for me to expect it to back down. You know, it took so long for it to really to get going from Door County down to Racine County. I mean, that's been a phenomenon the last 8 to 10 years. Mm. Whereas, you know, in Spooner and whatnot, this has been a problem since the 70s. So there has been some transition there. But it really is interesting to watch. And it's going to be a stay tuned, because the more they look, there is more than just Lyme disease floating around in those ticks now. There's at least 5 organisms. In fact, to be honest, I think there's 7 from what I'm hearing from Susan and some of the research that's going on. And so people are going to have to really think, if you're an outdoor person, anytime there's not snow on the ground, one should take some protection and precautions to prevent the ticks, and then check yourself out when you come home. And don't listen to Phil's advice all the time, because I pulled one out of my back about 3 weeks ago I had been out bow hunting and on a Monday, and I didn't find the tick till Thursday. And, you know, that's not good.
And what is the authoritative information on how long they need to be bit into you before they can inject you with the toxin? I hear 36 hours now. It keeps getting longer and longer.
Yeah, well, it's 36 to 48. It's in that range. And the reason, I mean, there's a complicated feeding mechanism that's going on here, where the organisms have to migrate out of the tick's gut tract. They don't start doing that till the tick starts pumping saliva in. In the first few hours, the tick is not feeding on you. It's cutting this little feeding apparatus. It's like a barbed thumb that's putting into you. We call the hypostome. So that's why, generally speaking, if you pull it off within 36 to 48 hours, even if it was carrying the disease, you will not get sick. On the other hand, in my case, where I knew my exposure was Monday, the tick was there in a hard place to see on my back. That was the problem on Thursday. So the recommendations now from the Center for Disease Control in Wisconsin, when we have about a 40% infectivity rate, so that's basically 2 out of 5 adults in the state, is if you get a tick like that on you right away, you talk to the family physician, and they'll give you 1 day's dose of doxycycline. I think it's 200 milligrams, and that's done, because the spirochete is very localized. The longer you go from that initial exposure is where life gets more complicated and treatment gets more complicated. But I think that's something people have to know. If you know, you're out Monday and you find the tick Monday, you know, it wasn't feeding. You find a tick at this time of the year, it's a deer tick. I mean, it's 95% plus of what I see come in the lab are deer ticks. Interesting enough, those males that you see do not feed in the adult stage, at least to the point that we think they can transmit. They're basically more interested in mating and not feeding is what's going on there. Whereas when you see that dark black shield with that orangish red abdomen, that's a classic adult female. You know it's a deer tick. There's just no question.
Yeah, there we go. There you go, Jim.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that greatly.
Yeah, appreciate your call. Gave Phil a chance to talk about it. So what did you, have you, are you worried yourself? Or are you, did you go and see the doctor or are you?
I sent an email to my doctor and just made a couple comments about knowing what the CDC recommendations were. And I had the prescription at the pharmacy within about 2 hours. And so, as I said,
there you go.
It goes, what's more interesting as we're getting deeper and deeper into this is these other Lyme-like organisms. Because I think medically they're harder to diagnose. And honestly, I think it's starting to clear up the picture to me of people that you said, well, it doesn't fit Lyme. The blood tests weren't there and whatnot, but these people are very sick. And all of a sudden this brings up the question, or this is a different organism. It is Lyme-like. It is tick-induced. But it, again, it complicates the medical side. Plus, we've got babesiosis, we've got ehrlichiosis, we've got anaplasmosis and a Powassian virus. As I said, this tick is capable of transmitting a number of problems
to
people.
Nasty things. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in, taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. A little later on, just at 2 o'clock today on the Kathleen Dunn Show, Wisconsin has the highest achievement gap in the nation, according to national test results released last week. And Kathleen and her guests discuss why Wisconsin ranks near the bottom for reading and math scores for African-American students. Right now, though, taking your insect questions with Phil, join us at 1-800-642-1234 or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. Carol and Genesee, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, we brought in some poinsettia plants, and ever since we've had all these little flies. They like to fly at our face. They're not fruit flies. I put tape around the outside of the planter, and I caught some of them. But I wanted to know if there's something that I can use that won't kill the plant, because it must be in the soil from the, you know,
sure.
plant.
My guess is they're fungus gnats feeding on the organic matter of the soil.
Okay.
So that's how you have to address them. If you go to a larger plant store nursery, there are some special bacterial insecticides that can be put in. What I used to know is called Natout. Natrol is another name, and I'm sure you can find names. It's a form of BT, but it's a form that kills maggots. And you just put the powder on. It will do nothing to kill the adults, but the maggots that feed on it will die. But it's very safe to have around them. You don't worry about pets. You don't worry about anything. And so that would be my first suggestion, is to work some of that in the soil. The other thing is try to reduce any unneeded organic matter. So dead leaves and whatnot that sometimes people like to put in thinking that they'll recycle nutrients, which is true, but that gives more food for the gnats to breed on. And so it's best to get that stuff out of there.
All right.
Okay, so it's a fungus gnat.
Right.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks, Carol. And Susan in Wausau, hello to you.
Hello. I have a question about moss.
Okay.
I have in the past, I didn't last year, I buy mothballs, and I usually keep our winter sweaters in the basement in a trunk with mothballs. Last year I didn't, but when my husband put on his sweaters, people noticed the smell. And then we noticed a couple of sweaters with moth holes in them. And I'm just questioning, if I never see a moth, how they get into, like, dresser drawers, because these sweaters are in dresser drawers or are they in the trunk, with or without mothballs? And how do the moths get in and destroy a wall? And the smell of mothballs, it's hard to get rid of. Is there anything else you recommend that has less odor that we could protect our winter sweaters in the summer or whatever we do with them?
Well, you know, I find, traditionally, more of the damage on woolens is caused by carpet beetles. Clothes moths, I can't say I don't see them, but they're more typically on rugs and the like.
Crickets, even.
Crickets. I'm not a big fan of mothballs. Part of the deal is if you throw something in there, you know, it builds up to a toxic enough level. But to be honest, if you put garments that are clean in tight-fitting containers, there should be no bug issue. They can't get in there. They can't drill through the plastic. So it's all about how well the seal is on it.
Okay.
So that's my recommendation to people. And typically, the damage is done in storage. Now, I cannot go in anybody's house and not find carpet beetles if you let me look in your windowsills and whatnot, because they feed on animal hair and dead insects and wasp nests and whatnot. So there's always a few present. And so there's always this risk. But again, a clean garment put into a snap top plastic container and whatnot, there is just no way they will get to them. And putting things on the floor is more risky, or putting it even on a closet shelf. And during the winter, when we're wearing these things, they get brushed off. I mean, it's a very slow process. This does not happen overnight. And as I said, the mothballs, or moth ice, which is paradichlorobenzene, I just don't see an advantage to it if you understand how the critters get there. And now, if you've got something stored in the attic for 5 years in a leaky trunk, boy, you know, then even if you put the mothballs in, they would have dissipated by that point, and the critters would have access.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you.
Okay, one more question. Quick question. Then, do they attack just in the summer, or are they here in the winter also?
Anytime the temperature is above 50 degrees where they are found, they're capable of being active. You know, closed moths, you know, most of the closed moths I see are called case-making closed moths. And the reason I can say I think that most of the damage is carpet beetle is carpet beetle doesn't leave a whole lot behind for people to look at. Case-making closed moths leave little cigar-like tubes right next to where they've been feeding. And so most of the time when people give me a call, you know, they don't see the tube. So I can make my diagnosis from that. Now, when I get a hole in cotton, it's not insect in most cases. You know, there's nothing in cotton in synthetic fibers other than some of the rayons silverfish will feed on occasion. But as I said, more often than not, holes that show out of nowhere, you worry about catching on something, or, you know, it's more of a physical type of hole. Whereas if you really are a good detective, insects are located with it. There'll be cast skins. There'll be little peppery-like insect waste grains and those kind of things. And those are the things that I tend to look for when I'm trying to sort out, is it insect-related or is it physical?
Thanks very much for calling, Susan. Appreciate it. And Phil, I'm going to take a look at the screen here. We've got on Facebook, listener Pat says here's a photo of some worms that have congregated on the foundation of our church in Colfax.
Sure. So those are millipedes. They curl up. Sometimes people refer to them as wireworms, but wireworms are a different type of animal. Quite common in the September period of time, but we do see it at other times of the year. Millipedes live in the soil, feed on organic matter, and they go through this migratory phase, and they're doing this at night. So they're out cruising around, and when the sun starts coming up, they look for places that are cool, damp, and dark. So foundations, north sides of houses, cement slabs in the garage, they pile up sometimes 2 inches deep.
Yeah, and they're kind of nasty-looking thing. Though.
Right, but they're harmless. I mean, interesting enough, they contain some cyanide to them, so that's why birds and other things tend to avoid them. They're not that edible, per se. So this is a contamination problem. What's frustrating to people is they're not breeding in the foundation around this building. They could be coming from 300 yards away. You know, somewhere there's a big field with a lot of organic matter in the soil, and that's where the millipedes have been doing very well. And as I said, now they're dispersing out from that. So I'm not real keen. You know, people can do some spraying. They will knock some down. But as far as solving the problem, it usually resolves in a couple, 3 weeks on its own. Anything you can do to promote dryness, light, and the like, it'll be less attractive to them. But again, if you got a lot of shrubbery or, again, a nice stone foundation, that's heaven, and you're not going to replace the foundation. But I'm trying to understand what's going on here. And as I said, usually what happens if you get a real bad year where there's just tremendous numbers, their populations crash, and it might be quite some time before you see that phenomena again.
And they're little brown, kind of brown, dark brown.
Yeah. So what would, with a hand lens, some kind of magnification, what makes them a millipede is they've got one pair of legs for every one of their little ring-like segments of the body. So they literally have 60, 70, 80 pairs of legs. Insects only have 6 legs total. So that's one of the ways that's a giveaway. Again, it's quite characteristic. Those could even be dead, because when they die, they have this hard outer shell. So they just still sit there. They take a long time to degrade. But, you know, I remember on the show a few years ago, a gentleman had called and he said he had a culvert in front of the house. He could fill 2 5-gallon buckets a day from the ones that would accumulate there. And so you get the idea of the sheer mass and numbers that can be coming in the right situation.
But speaking of numbers, you've often said vacuum up, you know, if you've got a few. And Chris in Oak Creek wonders, if you vacuum up an insect, does it die or can it live to crawl back out?
You know, the dust and stuff that is found mixed in the vacuum cleaner is tough on a lot of insects.
Okay.
There's two insects, though, that I would say I would get rid of the vacuum cleaner bag after I did it. Fleas and bed bugs.
Oh.
Because all it takes is one or two to get past you and you're back into the cycle again. So that is a special case. One of the other things I've seen with some of these, the bed bug wars that we've been going through, is people will take something like a nylon stocking, put the vacuum cleaner in, when the stuff's getting through, they get caught there, and then they can just wrap that up and throw it away rather than having to recycle the whole bag. So there's a couple tricks to it. But generally speaking, small numbers, no. The other thing, though, is if somebody went out there for these millipedes and vacuumed them up in a shop vac, let's say, I would highly recommend to dispose of it, because they're so high in fat that if you let all those dead bodies sit in there, within a day or two, your nose will tell you that something's rotten, and it's basically the decaying insects. So as I said, so normally, you know, a couple spiders here and there, I don't worry about. But if you have large quantities of insects, it's probably best to just dispose of the dead bodies or get them out of there, just because, again, you don't want to have the odor problem.
Marion in Windsor up next. Hi, Marion.
Hi. Yeah, a follow-up question on the fungus gnats.
Yeah.
Do you think that diatomaceous earth works as well as that gnat out?
No, because if you were to mix the diatomaceous earth with your potting mix when you planted the plant, I would say yes, because it's dispersed throughout the root tissue and the critters can't go someplace where they don't get it. The problem with sprinkling diatomaceous earth on the surface is the maggots are feeding down below that. So that's the problem with it. The bacterial product, when they come up to feed, they ingest it, and that's what kills them. It's technically a stomach poison. And a lot of times, so that's the problem with diatomaceous earth. If when you understand how it works, there's often a case of, am I getting it at the right concentration, in the right place to do the job? And as I said, I get a little nervous for something like fungus gnats, because unless it's pre-mixed in the potting mix, and it's definitely these non-organic potting mixes are far less attractive, whereas taking soil from the outside that has organic matter mixed in it, honestly, you're asking for a fungus gnat problem, because you've got the kind of stuff. The richer the soil, the happier they are.
Yeah, I've never used the outdoor type soil, but I have had the fungus gnats. And the diatomaceous earth spread on the top of the plant, you know, after it's been planted a while, and underneath, I mean, I didn't know that there was going to be fungus gnat problems, so I couldn't mix it with the soil. But it did seem to work fairly well. I put it in the saucer also, so that the bug tried to get out there.
Yeah, it's all about if you can expose the maggots to it, it's an abrasive, it will kill them. It's just a question of where they are versus where you can put the stuff.
Okay, and that gnat out, is that the correct name?
That's one of the commercial names. The active ingredient is Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis, or we call it BTI for short. Okay. It's the same thing in the mosquito dunks that they sell for putting in ponds to kill mosquitoes. But as I said, you will see specialized products for houseplant soil. The other place, if you got no place close by, Gardens Alive, which is kind of an organic specialty company, sells a version of BTI for people. And so that would be another source.
There you go.
Jung's Garden Center?
Yes, I have seen it at Jung's.
Oh, good. Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Barbara in Zion, Illinois, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am wondering why we are not more educated on some of the good aspects of bed bugs. For instance, hornworms, which turn into sphinx moths, which are great pollinators of a lot of our plants, the hummingbird moth and the hawk moth, which pollinates the white-fringed orchid that is kind of endangered. I'm a great fan of insects anyway.
Yeah, okay. Well, Phil, what about it?
Well, typically, you know, from my perspective, most people I talk to don't have the time or interest in talking about insects unless the insect is doing something you don't want. And so that's where we kind of start from, that it's a pest. Now, you know, when you let us get on the podium and start talking about insects, we tell you that probably about 2% of the insects at best are pests of people, and the other one's doing all kinds of things, whether it's degrading organic matter for recycling things, pollinating our plants, eating bad bugs. I mean, there's just an incredible list, so you can assume that 98% of them are at worst neutral, but most of the cases are beneficial. And as you point out, it's kind of like weeds to people. You know, one person's flower in the garden could be somebody else's weed. And, you know, you can look into the, it's an invasive. I mean, there's all kinds of factors that come into it. But I agree, most people, and as a society, we are not tolerant of insects. I mean, there are other cultures where insects are held at least in somewhat higher regard. Again, just the diversity. And, you know, as a biologist, the argument is they're in control here. Anybody thinks that we've got we're running the show here. We're totally dependent on what they do, and we're never going to get rid of them. And so, you know, as Tom Eisner always says, it's time to make peace with the landlord. And I think if you do take that perspective of taking a step back, seeing what's going on there, you tend to appreciate even something like the hornworm that, mm-hmm. that you know, may cost you a tomato plant every once in a while. But ultimately, they have their place in nature. Now, occasionally somebody will ask me the question, you know, what good are mosquitoes and whatnot? And I will tell you, there are some insects that, from a human perspective, I can't say anything nice about. You know, and although there are some mosquitoes that pollinate plants, my gut feeling is there are some other flying gnats and whatnot that could pollinate the same plants if we could get rid of the mosquitoes. But I'm looking at it from a human perspective and not, like I said, a broader picture. So.
Well, I'm with you on getting rid of the mosquitoes. Although I didn't have much of a problem this year.
Well, you know, it was interesting in the southern part of the state. We had such a wet and cool spring. And we see this phenomenon sometimes when you get so much water that we have a lot of places that could be potential breeding sites, but they keep flooding out. You know, they just kind of wash them down the river as a way of thinking about it. And then, well, all of a sudden, we took this great turn to how dry it is. And mosquitoes do not do well when it's dry. And so, boy, from the middle of July on, we just have not had the rainfall patterns to give us much problem. You know, very few cases of West Nile in the state, although I was talking to a colleague down in Chicago. And they, you know, we got in the conversation because I found a couple dead crows in my front yard that I knew were associated with West Nile. And the mosquito that spreads that isn't as dependent on rainfall. It's more dependent on people's pools and flower pots and the like. And he was saying that things were hopping pretty good down in Chicago. And maybe not as many people cases, but boy, they were tracking. There was a lot of virus moving around.
We had a Facebook question from Jim, who had many yellow jacket wasps entering an outdoor soffit area near a downspout in September and October. He says, I found one in the house last week. Will they return to the same area next year?
Okay. So the good news at this time of the year, it's all over and it will not reappear. So there was a paper wasp nest in the wall void or in your attic. And it was there probably since May, but the numbers were so low it didn't get your attention. By about the 1st of November, typically, they will die out, not because of the cold, but they starve to death. And their biology is such, they do not come back to the nest again. So there's no reason to worry about. Now, the other side of it, though, is if there was an opening around a vent or a soffit and whatnot, it would behoove you just to kind of get that sealed up. The only time it's a mistake to seal that up is if we were in August and we saw them coming and going. Then it would be a big mistake because then you'll drive them in the house and then we've got some problems. So usually I tell people if it's in a place there's not a lot of people traffic, let it resolve like it has now and then repair it from there. You'll get a couple stragglers. They overwinter as fertilized queens. And sometimes what we find is, you know, if you got an older farmhouse, there's so many cracks and crevices for things to crawl into. It's not unusual to find a few queens. Or in the spring of the year, when you see the wasp, those are the queens that have woken up and, you know, come down through a light fixture or whatnot. They probably spent the whole winter up in the attic, but not much to worry about there typically.
Tim and Eastman, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. My question is about on wood ticks.
Yeah.
I've got a friend that I hunt with regularly, and we travel through the same areas of woods, walk through the same brush piles, the same grass patches. When we get out of the woods, he'll have six or seven ticks on him, and I never seem to have any. Is there something about individual people that a tick prefers over another one?
Not as much as with mosquitoes, where mosquitoes are a much quicker feeder. You know, ticks are responding to heat and carbon dioxide, which doesn't differ that much. My first thought with what you've experienced is it's the fabric of your clothes. You find that very, you know, fine brushed cotton and whatnot that doesn't have any nap to it is not a good place to get ticks. You get something like a pair of wool pants or similar things, and it's like a tick magnet. And so I'm just wondering, compare your clothes to see if he's got something that is easier for the ticks to latch onto, and that may be the what's going on.
Yeah.
Well, we wear roughly the same thing, so I'll just consider myself lucky.
Yeah. There you go, Tim. But keep be vigilant. You yes. never know when one's going to turn up on your back, and you don't see it for a few days.
Yeah, it was interesting because when I turned around, I was pretty sure it looked like somebody had poked me real good with a pencil. But I, again, couldn't see it so well. So I went up to and asked my wife, "Does this spot have legs?" And her answer was, "It has two legs." I said, "Well, now I'm confused because it should have eight." But then right away, I knew it was a deer tick and the like. And it's not the first time. And again, I guess, the problem with my own advice is I don't always follow it because I should do a tick check every night. Even with doing that, as I said, there's been three or four times in my lifetime when I've been crawling around out in the woods and, oh, dear, look what I found.
Oh, yeah. And you're out a lot, so... Yeah.
Well, I asked for it. But, you can go. It's so interesting. You can go to different places in the property that I do a lot of bow hunting on. I can find an occasional one. But all I have to do is drive 10 miles down the road and go look for them, and I can find them by the bucketful. And
yeah. Amazing, isn't it? Alex in New Glarus, hi to you.
Hi. I have two comments that I'd like Phil to comment back about.
Sure.
And they seem to be on the famous topic or the continuing topic of ticks again, so it's to do with deer ticks. And the first one is I hunt quite a bit in Iowa County, and I, at one point 20 years ago, got 40 ticks onto my pants in an hour and a half hike. Seems impossible, but that was the nature of my job as I was in the woods hiking up and down. Now if you go to that same property, you might find one. So there's definitely been an ebb and a tide to the tick population for deer ticks, and I'm not exactly sure if that just coincides perfectly with a decreased deer population or maybe a disease that's got in there. So
yeah. My comment might be in vegetation change, because a lot of the early work that I was involved with deer ticks was in Iowa County, and we were over by Arena, and you go on the top of the ridges that were pretty open, no deer ticks. You got down the bottom where it was wet and swampy, none, but you got that side hill with a lot of raspberries. So as I said, that's why I was teasing the gentleman earlier. The worst place in the world to find deer ticks is where a grouse hunter would go looking for grouse.
Yeah.
And so if the understory has changed because they've done some TSI in there to improve the forest, or they've done some burning or whatnot, those will have major effects on the populations over time. It seems that the ticks are very sensitive to drying out, so they're looking for places that stay kind of damp, that there's a lot of litter in there. And as I said, so I think of a wooded situation with a lot of understory is the worst spot. And same conversation with people. They're up in a tree stand, they come down through a ridge and walk through a raspberry patch, and they're covered with ticks. I point to the raspberry patch as being the source.
Yep, there you go. Thanks, Alex, for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in. And we have one open line. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. John emailed us several weeks ago. I woke to find a tick on my hand.
Mm-hmm.
I assumed that since it was not full from feeding, it hadn't bit me.
Now, see, normally are what we call hard ticks. Those are the ones that people experience. The feeding process is 3 to 5 days. So they're either attached like glue and you can't get them off, or indeed they are just crawling. That would suggest there's no reason to believe that it was feeding on you. It's not like a mosquito that everything happens in, in a matter of seconds and the like. So you can be pretty well assured if it was just crawling and moving that it had not fed.
Facebook question. By the way, you can ask a Facebook question. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And Tricia did that and wants to know if box elder bugs have any purpose. Does anything eat them?
some things try, but they do have some very bad tasting chemicals in their body. Well, that's why they're so brightly colored. They advertise they're there. So the things that, you know, mice and whatnot will learn somewhat that they're not the best tasting things. So their main natural enemy, as far as we're concerned, is a fungus disease that relies on moisture. And so that's what ebbs and flows the population. They feed on the seeds of box elder trees. One can only wonder how many box elder trees we'd have out there if they didn't reduce the seed load. So there is a positive side. Do you think about it? Because box elder is not held in very high esteem, I think, for most people as far as a tree out in the woods. And so, yeah, they do have their purpose, and they will also breed on silver maple, which is, you know, box elder is in the maple genus. They're related. Terrible last year. Honestly, really very quiet this year, which I think relates a lot to that heavy moisture level and whatnot in the spring that got the fungus going, and that's what kept them down.
Kevin in Green Bay. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Two quick questions. One is regarding ants in the lawn. My lawn is really infested with little small brown ants. I've put different things on there, and it doesn't seem to hold them back. And my second question would be, I have a cabin in northern Wisconsin, and in the fall, I tend to get, I guess they're called cluster flies, and I'm wondering how to keep them knocked down also.
Okay, so the first one for the cluster flies, first week of September, you spray the outside of the structure with one of the pyrethroid insecticides, you know, things like Ortho Bug Be Gone, and I mean, there's many products, and most of what you see on the shelves nowadays are this type of product. They both have a repellency and a knockdown, but the secret is to get it on before they start coming in, and I would use the 1st of September as the time to apply it to the sunny sides in the soffits, the overhangs, because that's the weakness that they're getting in. And if you wait till the middle of October, it's too late. Now, the problem with the ants out in the lawn, to kill an ant, you got to kill the queen. She's down in the ground. Anything you apply to the surface gets caught in the top and doesn't go down there. So we've talked before on the show, if you've got these big field ant mounds that are, you know, 2 feet wide and 6 inches deep, you know, you can put a couple, three channels or holes down into the nest and pour this mixture on to get them. But when you've got hundreds of small little nests, the only way to do it is sit there with a screwdriver, pump it down into each nest and pour a little stuff. And so you're basically hand treating every nest. And I will guarantee you next summer they will start coming back. Now, the argument is, you know, that kind of ant, I think what you have are called cornfield or laziest ants, don't cause really much of a problem. They'll kick out some sand between some pavement bricks and whatnot on occasion. It's not an ant that comes indoors. It's not an ant that bites. It honestly is you could probably argue, helps to aerate the soil because of their activity. And so I know they're frustrating, but as I said, the logistics of trying to go after, which I've seen, you know, papers to suggest that you could easily find 20 of these per square yard in any, especially lighter soils. And so that you're just talking about thousands of nests out in the lawn, and that's why it's so difficult to get rid of them.
Yep. There you go. Thanks, Kevin. Thank you. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Russ in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Russ.
Morning. A couple of years ago, we had cave crickets, and we know because I sent him the film and he identified them. And then in February 2 years ago, we caught one about the size of a baseball. We had to use a fishing net. Well, once we got that one out of there, we didn't have any more. But now this year, we've caught three or four again, and I'm wondering where they're coming from.
Sure. So it's an outside predator. And in the fall of the year, they're looking for, I think, shelter to spend the winter. So if typically the people that give me the most calls on this are people that live in bluffy, rocky areas that are kind of damp and like, and that's just the natural habitat. So they must be migrating in from outside, which opens up the door to what can I seal? What can I, you know, prevent them from getting access? They will not thrive indoors, but the source is always outside. So typically it's kind of a fall, early winter problem, and then we really don't see much activity because the house starts to dry down so much that they just kind of die off.
There you go.
Okay.
Thanks, Russ. And Shelby in Black River Falls. Hi.
Hi, how are you, Dr. Phil Politeri?
Doing fine.
All right. In fact, I just wanted to thank you for the contributions you've made to the structural pest control industry. And my wife earlier this year, I guess, scored the highest in your insect identification on your master's exam.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
Which Dr. Phil Politeri is also the one who wrote and proctored mine. I was the second group, Dr. Phil, when I went through it, Dr. Politeri. So I just wanted to thank you for your contributions to structural pest control. It's been huge, and it's one of the driving factors why I became a sustained contributor to the station.
Oh,
well thank you.
Really
I very
nice.
Much appreciate that.
And
I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say maybe, Phil, you could talk about this program.
Well, the Wisconsin Pest Control Association is basically the structural pest control industry in the state. And it's been very interesting for me to watch in my career as my career is winding down now is that, you know, I will tell you, one of the things that I've really been delighted with is to watch how professional the people who go about doing business in this state have become. And, you know, it's become a very sophisticated, high information requirement type thing. Because, you know, we have to tailor what we do for pest control in different situations and the like. It's not just get something in a spray bottle and go and spray it. Life is far more complicated, as I said. The industry has been a delight to work with because of the direction they've gone. Unfortunately, we've got some very frustrating problems to deal with, things like bed bugs and whatnot that just don't lend themselves to easy control. But that, again, speaks to why we need professionals to do this kind of stuff. So as I said, it has been fun for me in my career. And plus, when we all get together, we're all just bug people. So we have a great time talking about what's going on, which is kind of kindred spirits.
Thanks, Shelby.
It's an honor that you proctored me, Dr. Volteri. I really appreciate that.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks very much for calling, Shelby. We have Ed sent a couple of photos, actually, on my Facebook page. Phil, you want to take a look at those caterpillars? Pretty ones, kind of a gold or bright yellow stripe, and looks like purple, almost purple.
Sure. Okay, so I do not have my magic caterpillar book with me. I can tell you it's a noctuid moth. I think it's a brown owlet moth would be the common name it's given to it, but I would have to check my reference to be sure. There is a book on the caterpillars of Eastern North America out of Princeton University, which is very good. There also was an exquisite book done on the owlet moths, caterpillars, about a year or two ago. Both those books literally have hundreds of pictures of different species. And, you know, it's kind of intriguing because some of these things, you know, are just so beautiful in the larval stage, and they're just a drab gray moth when they grow up, and vice versa. You can never quite tell. And until this book came out, to be honest, I often did not have good enough reference material to be able to tell you what species, but something that's distinctive. And as I said, the first thing that comes to my mind is a brown owlet moth, but I would want to check my references before I'd be 100% sure.
Well, it's sure a beautiful caterpillar.
Yes.
Man,
and but you know, you can almost see how camouflaged it is.
Yeah,
you know how the outlines and breakups and whatnot, and in some species are even variable in color. You can have a brown form, a green form, a yellow form, and the like. But as I said, definitely the material to help you identify these things has become much more readily available now, and makes it easier. And then the other thing that I've liked in my career is the advent of you know, these digital cameras. I mean, it's just amazing the kind of pictures people can take and the kinds of things. And we talked about it on the show before, but 60% of what I process now are digital pictures rather than specimens themselves.
Amazing. We had an email from Don. I think it's kind of interesting. Don and DePere, and wants to know, what were the first insects to have evolved on Earth? Would we or should we expect to find similar insects on other worlds that would have similar atmospheres as ours? And do we look for insects when we send probes into space?
Ooh, interesting. The more primitive things like silverfish and the cockroaches in that group are kind of the ones that we point to as being some of the longest.
Among
now,
the
you
earliest.
Know, they're related to the crustaceans out of the ocean, and so they kind of evolved out of that. My gut feeling on things is they evolve differently in different places, and it's so interesting when you listen to the people that talk about, you know, where we are now and what happened to the dinosaurs and was it a coincidence of a giant comet hitting? And, you know, there's so many things that influence that you cannot predict that have a major. So who knows? I mean, you know, some people have, in science fiction, talked about we're all carbon-based. Or what about in a planet that's silica-based? What would the animals look like? You know, and so, as I said, my gut feeling is things would be different. I think they're more looking for more primitive life forms, you know, bacteria, viruses, those kind of things when they're doing their probes. Because if you find that, then you can see the building blocks to evolve to some other form of animal. But I don't automatically assume they'll be insects. Even though most science fiction, when you see the people coming out of the spaceship, they are very insect-like, it seems, for whatever reason.
Yeah, for whatever reason. Yeah, absolutely. They always seem that way. Well, I don't think Jamie in Colfax has a question about those kinds of insects, but here's something else. Jamie, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I'm from Colfax, and there's been an instance of head lice going around the school. So I'm just curious if you could give some, you know, tips and prevention, treatment. Sure.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, you don't use people's combs, you don't use people's hats. I mean, head lice have to be transferred from personal items, typically. I'm a big proponent of some of the natural treatments like coconut oil and olive oil, because the problem we've been having is a lot of the over-the-counter things, there's been resistance to some of the pesticides that are evolved and the like. And so, but we're not in a society that deals with it. I mean, it's really much more common than people think. But, you know, typically you get an outbreak because nobody's paying any attention. And before you know it, the whole third grade class has got it because, you know, they were doing, you know, a play and they all were using the same little hats and whatnot. So you can see much more common in kids, you know. And then once the kids bring it home, there is a potential transfer in the family. But they're not as contagious as people think when you understand that, again, typically they have to be on items that people have. And as I said, so, you know, you can go on the internet and get the olive oil treatments, you know, it's basically leaving it on for 8 hours, suffocating it, you know, washing maybe the pillowcase and the sheets, cleaning the combs, you know.
Yeah, and that'll do it. Well, Phil Pelletieri, our UW Extension entomologist, is going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We're going to take a look at the news and the weather, and we'll find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet. And then you can join in with your questions. We'll be right back after this look at the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Great to have him along, and thank you so much for listening in today. We're going to take some calls. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you to the corporate sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like Madison Gas and Electric, Al Johnson's Swedish Restaurant, and Rittenhouse play a huge role in the success of WPR. For more information, go to wpr.org/sponsor.
Support also comes from Madison Community Montessori School, serving families in the Madison area since 1972 for toddler through eighth grade. Presenting an open house on November 21st from 8:45 to 10 a.m. More at madisoncommunitymontessori.org.
Again, if you have a question for our guest, Phil Pelletieri, join us at 800-642-1234. Mary has a question, and let's go to her. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I have a sore throat, so have to bear with me.
That's right.
I have a problem with some bugs in my bed, but first I want to start out. You know when you get those little flower bugs? They're little tiny little brown things in your flower?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's the same thing that's in the bed.
Hmm. But they're not biters. They're not bed bugs.
No.
Well, that's a new one.
I've taken it all apart and looked to see if there was something dropped there, you know, a dog with some food item or something, and there's nothing around.
Yeah, okay. So, to be honest, there is probably about 35 species of little red beetles that are associated with food products.
These are little brown.
Yeah, but they're all brown. And until I get them in the scope, they all kind of work the same, that they have to feed on dried plant material. So, things like potpourri, dried flower arrangements, nuts, wreaths made out of, you know, natural plant products are all potential food sources. I can't think of anything that would be in the bed per se. So then the question is, are they just falling in? Then on top of that, I've got little red beetles like that are fungus beetles. And most of the fungus beetles fly, which most of the insects in food do not. If you were seeing a bunch of those, it would suggest to me you got a wet wall or the like. But again, even though they're appearing on the bed, my gut feeling is the source is not the bed. It's something else in the environment. Best thing I can do is get some critters to me. It's one of those things that there's just so many things that look alike. At least I think I can point you to a more specific direction if I'm absolutely sure which it is.
So put some in a...
Yeah, put it in, you know, any kind of... you can mail it. The only caution with mailing things is if you just take a couple dead bugs, throw it in an envelope and get it to me, it's powder when I get to... So it's best if you somehow, you know, put it in tissue or something else. Yeah, some kind of container that will protect it so they don't get crushed.
Yeah, a little box or
the box will be great.
What's the address?
The lab is 1630 Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N Drive, Madison. The university zip is 53706. And if you just send it to the insect lab, I get all that material.
Oh, just insect lab?
Right.
Yep, 1630 Linden.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Richard in Huntley, Illinois. Hello.
Hello. All right. Well, listen, I'm calling because about a month ago, I had a invasion of praying mantis, more than I've ever seen in my life. I was able to sit down in a little chair in the middle of a natural growing area, and they were just everywhere, and I've never seen so many. I couldn't even tell you how many, but they were all over. They were everywhere flying, and I just thought, locally, I've never seen it, and I didn't know if it's something to do with the weather.
Yeah,
I know it's good for...
A couple perspectives. I wonder if you were, because of the time of the year, there was some mating going on, and that may have concentrated them, because they're usually kind of territorial. The other phenomena is, you know, I always tell people, although, you know, I knew what a mantid was, we did not have breeding populations in this part of the country until the last 10 to 15 years. So it has been a more recent phenomenon, and the populations are building. There's no question in my mind, because we did not consider them breeding in Wisconsin up until about 10 years ago. Same for Iowa and northern Illinois would be the same. It used to be it was cold enough that their egg cases would freeze out, but it's not that cold anymore. And so I think we're starting to see, as I said, the populations move both farther north and their populations increasing because of the weather conditions.
Mm-hmm. So that's a positive, right?
Yes. It's not going to control the spider mites in your garden because they don't feed on spider mites, but they are beneficial. They're a very attractive creature. It gets people's attention. Knowing, again, we had talked earlier, we never say any good thing about insects. Well, it's very hard to say anything bad about praying mantids. So people recognize it and the like, so that can only be good.
Yep, there we go. Thanks, Richard.
I had a wonderful time. Thank you for your information.
Yeah, appreciate it. Facebook question from George. I have two questions about ticks. Are they nocturnal, and do they drop down out of trees?
So my colleague Susan Paskowitz, who works with ticks and mosquitoes, sent her students out at 1 in the morning to do tick drags and found sure indeed, and it makes so much sense, if they like to feed on small rodents when they're small, why wouldn't they be more active when the rodents are? And so there is more activity at night when a lot of people aren't crawling in the woods. So that's maybe why people don't see it. Not so much dropping from trees. Now, if you think about it, they're sitting in the shrubbery in the bushes waiting for animals to come by and latch onto, and it would be very stupid to be up in the trees. They don't have eyes. They sense the carbon dioxide and heat when things are close, and then they latch on is the way they work. But the way I explain it to a lot of people is when I'm walking in the woods, you know, I've got pants and a shirt on. If one latches on, it's going to start crawling. And the first place I'm probably going to find it and feel it is on my neck and head. And so you get the impression they start high, but they really start low and go from there. And so I won't say that on occasion, I talk to people or whatnot where you thought they kind of blew in. I think they were just kind of more by accident. They don't drop out of trees. They just don't work that way. And it wouldn't make sense for them to work that way.
Alex had a comment about transporting ticks via deer carcasses. He recommends skinning the deer as soon as possible, get rid of the hide before the ticks drop off. Alternatively, he hangs the carcass over a barrel with some cooking oil in the bottom, and when the carcass cools, the ticks drop off and the oil makes it impossible for them to crawl out.
That would be a solution. Interesting enough, though, most of the ticks that are on the deer are already in some stage of feeding, and unlike mosquitoes that would start to feed on me and if I disturb it go to you, they can't feed that way. So they're not much of a problem. To be honest, I was involved with skinning a deer out earlier this week, and I could hear them dropping as the carcass cooled. And so you do got to clean that up. It's best to get it out of there. I don't worry about them breeding there, but it's just a nuisance. And if you're concerned about that, you get rid of the hide. There will not be ticks on the meat. They just don't work that way.
Greg and Manchez, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Oh, this is a great show. I always look forward to it. I kind of was born thinking about everything that moves and crawls. So,
cool.
But, you know, it's also ironic about the caller a few calls ago who talked about seeing so many praying mantises, but I noticed he was from Illinois. And that was really, I've seen walking sticks every once in a while here. I live on a farm, and I've only seen a couple of them in all my 30-some years of living here. But a praying mantis I've never seen in Wisconsin, and I had understood recently that we had them, and it was really interesting for me to catch your discussion as I waited for my call to be made. What kind of habitat would I look for them with? And you got that other guy's address?
First of all, what county are you in?
I'm in Washington County.
Okay. I've seen quite a bit out of Milwaukee, a little bit of Ozaukee. They're really more of a bush and shrub insect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they like hedges. That's where they will be foraging a lot. They're quite good flyers in the adult stage. They're hard to concentrate when they're immatures because they're cannibalistic. They'll eat each other. And again, there's this territorial behavior. So I think where a lot of people see them is in the late summer when the adults are active and moving, that one of all of a sudden land on your garage or something, and that's what catches your attention. But if you're going to look for more, quote, breeding habitat, as I said, that's where I would look for, is places that are hedgy and bushy and shrubby, and just see them basically sitting there waiting for prey to come by.
Okay, yeah, I've been so fascinated with them that a couple times I ordered egg cases and they just didn't hatch out.
Mm-hmm.
Except once that after 3 weeks of waiting or a month of waiting, I thought, all right, forget about it. Then I looked in the container that I had them in, and there are a whole bunch of dead little hatchlings.
It's tough, and it's tough to get them food when they're that small type of thing, and so. You know, I know some people have just taken them out in the garden. It used to be early in my career when somebody would find one, I'd say, well, one of your neighbors ordered an egg case and they reared out, but we wouldn't see it. I would see the egg cases show up on nursery stock from down south. And as I said, in a sheltered site, once in a while, you'd get them kind of limping through. But now it's the other phenomena, is that I get far more questions and people are seeing them, have never seen them before. And as I said, we know they're breeding here. And there's two species of mantid. There's both the Chinese mantid and the European mantid. That can be found in the state. And we do have a breeding population of European mantids up in Door County. Now, the thing that I always thought about there is that, you know, the climate is just temperate enough because the lake effect, that would be a logical place for them to be able to establish versus, you know, in colder parts of the state. But as I said, now I basically draw a line across the bottom third of the state and nothing surprises me down here.
Oh, thanks, Greg. Thank you very much for calling. Dave in Sheboygan, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Question. Late September, early October, I had some insects bore under the sheeting on my cedar-sided house. All I saw was the frass. I never saw the insects. I sprayed the area with pyrethroid and don't know if I've gotten them or what they are.
Okay. One of the things that seems to be coming more commonplace also, and I think this is because of the mild winter, are carpenter bees. And carpenter bees will drill up into softened wood like cedar, and you get this sawdust coming out, but it should just be one hole. And if you were
it is one hole.
Yeah, if you sat and watched for a while, they look like bumblebees. They just have kind of a shiny abdomen to them. And so my first thought is that it is some form of carpenter bee. That would make more sense than anything else. Now, they're not overly destructive, although, you know, again, as the wood softens and the like, there is some problems there. They don't like to attack painted surfaces in most cases. Some cases replacing the wood. Wait and see.
They will overwinter then?
Yes, they overwinter. The grubs are in there with a bunch of pollen. They will develop on their own, and then they'll, you know, they don't come back. It's not a nest per se in the sense that it's. So it'll be interesting to see if you see anything, any kind of activity there. But if that persists, then you're going to have to start taking up some strategies. Typically what they'll do is if they're in a place you don't want them, they will just dust into that entrance hole to deal with them. And so when they come and go...
What kind of dust?
Any garden dust, to be honest.
Okay.
It's going to be 7 permethrin. I mean, they all kind of function the same, and you just blow a little dust there, and then when they come and go, the dust gets on them and the like. So.
And that's it.
Right. Yep.
Okay. No, I did spray them with pyrethroids, and I thought, I got them, but no, I don't think I did.
Yeah, I mean, this is like when we talk about wasp nests that go into walls. It's generally, if I can't see the nest, I don't know really where it is, and I find that the sprays tend to not to perform very well. whereas the dust, just because you know the way it coats the edges and the sides when things come and go, that's how they get it on their bodies. And so that's why I find dust, you know, they're not necessarily quick acting, like in 10 seconds like some of the wasp sprays, but in the long run they're far more effective and will take care of things.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thank you very much for calling. And on to Gus in Fitchburg. Gus, hello. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
Yeah. Speaking of wasps, I think they're yellow jackets. I took a huge nest out of my soffit on my bay window, and it was like 2,000 or so cells in this nest, and it was kind of up in there, and I knew there was a lot because I had a shop vac and I was sucking them as they came in, and I counted at least 1,500 or so that I sucked out just to get them out of there before I tried to reach in there and get that nest out during the nighttime when it was cold. But so I thought I took all of it out. I could see with a mirror up there that, you know, I couldn't see anything in there. And I foamed it all in tight so that they can't get into that area because it was fiberglass in there, underneath there. But the problem I have now is that there's a wasp every now or a hornet coming up into the room up above that through the vents. And they had been coming in before that into the room. I'd see about one a day, you know. So I've seen a couple in there. That I'm in that room still, so there's some in some area in the house. I'm wondering if I should try to tear out the ceiling to see if they're in there, or if I should just wait and see if they die down. Is it possible that there were just a bunch of strays in the insulation in there?
Could be. I just don't think it's worth being destructive and tearing things open because as I said, they can't eat. And so no matter how warm it is and whatnot, they'll starve to death. And so you can get some stragglers, but I just, as I said, I just don't think it's the kind of problem that warrants a whole lot more. The other thing that you can consider, you know, again, if it's in a child's bedroom and you're concerned that somebody's going to get stung, if there's any way, sometimes you can tape the vents or whatnot to the point that things couldn't get through, but yet you get the airflow you need. So just physically keep them away. But as I said, we got to be getting real close to things being shut down because it's getting so late in the season.
Yep. Thanks, Gus, for calling. John in Waukesha. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. Yeah, great to be on the air.
Thanks.
Say, I've got a question about yellow jackets. I've lived in my house for 30 years here, and I've always had them around, and they pretty much left me alone. They weren't very aggressive. They're the kind that their nests hang down from the soffits. But 2 years ago, in fact, a couple years ago, about 5 years ago, I noticed a smaller version of that wasp, which at first I thought was an immature version of what I'm used to. But this one is really nasty. And, boy, if you get anywhere near their nest and their nests are hidden, they'll really come at me. And I've been stung about six times. And I'm wondering if there's a new version of a yellow jacket
Yes.
that's around. Oh, it's smaller.
And it's not a yellow jacket. So it's interesting. Oh. What I suspect from what you describe is the European paper wasp, which is related to our native paper wasp. It is relatively new in the state. So 5 years ago is just about the time we started to see it picking up, especially in the southeast part of the state. It makes those small little, what I call exposed comb nests, that are typical in the soffits, but they hide it under things. I've had the same phenomena. I got zapped a couple, three times in my own yard, was cleaning the eaves or the leaves out of my eaves, and I got zapped, and I looked, and sure enough, behind the aluminum flashing, they had a nest. And when I'm poking around in there, I'm close to the nest, and they take offense at that. And so we do see, and these are the reports in Michigan and places where it's been seen more often, is that the European paper wasp is both more aggressive, and also it tends to put nests in places you don't see, so you can't avoid them. And so here to stay, unfortunately. In fact, there's even evidence they're displacing our native Polistes paper wasp. But that's what, and they look like a yellow jacket. But if you look at them really closely, there are some subtle differences. But they don't make the huge paper wasp nests that have the external envelope. They make those small, you know, maybe the size of a softball or smaller nests where you can see the little cells when you look up in there. But as I said, behind shingles and just all kinds of places. We had one in our sundial in the front porch, you know, and I'm moving the sundial, and that was a mistake. But as I said, they're notorious. I even had one try to make a nest in my gas door of my vehicle. It had been sitting for 4 or 5 days, and we hear about this, engines of cars and whatnot, where they're left. This doesn't happen a day, but if you have something sitting for a couple of weeks, then all of a sudden you've got a nest that's half built and... So an interesting creature, and your observation about something different is exactly right.
Yep.
Okay, they're new then, huh?
Yep, they are new, John. Thanks a lot for calling. And Dan in Madison, thanks to you for calling. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I got a question about fruit flies.
Okay.
My dad brought in a bunch of produce, late summer, early fall, and, he had some fruit flies in the house. And, they were getting kind of bad. And then he got rid of all that, because he had like a little sunroom or whatever that he kept this stuff in. Well, as I thought he was going to get rid of the whole food source. And the last time I went over there, man, they were everywhere. I mean, and I don't know what they're feeding on. Or he took garbage out. He took all the, tomatoes and squash, everything out. But he still has them pretty bad, and I don't know, I want to help him get rid of it before Thanksgiving.
So we got to be a detective here, because the source, when you throw things out, that if that was the main source, within 4 or 5 days, life would be so improved. And so if it doesn't improve, they found something else. They need moisture, they need organic matter, and they need yeast that we normally associate with things that are overly ripe and in some form of decay. So...
Okay.
All the things you mentioned, the produce, the pumpkins, the squash, that's all possible. I've seen them in gladiola corms and other bulbs that you bring in from outside to overwinter. I've seen them in recycling cans and things that don't get rinsed out properly. And then I tell the story from my own experience when my kids were small. I saw them breed in paper cups that had Kool-Aid in there. And when that Kool-Aid dried down, it gets slimy. But it's got sugar, it's got yeast, it's got moisture. They're happy as heck. And so there's got to be a source. I've seen them in sour mops. You spill some orange juice, you clean it up, you don't rinse that mop. The slime that builds on that when it's in the closet can breed fruit flies. So as I said, you got to keep poking around. And when you find the source, they're so short-lived in the adult stage. As I said, it's not as if, you throw it away and I'm putting up with it for a month. That doesn't work that way. It should improve within 3 or 4 days. If not, there's something still in the house and absolutely no way they could be coming in from outside now. So as I said, it's got to be an in thing. So it could be as innocent as just one squash or pumpkin he forgot about that rolled underneath something. And I don't even want to think about how many fruit flies I could breed from a small pumpkin. It would be
millions.
a lot. So
okay, well, I'll keep looking.
All right, Dan, good luck to you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, appreciate your call. Yeah, things are kind of winding down out there now. You're not gonna...
Yeah, in some sense, I mean, this is the time of the year that I start to do more lecturing, and then usually I'm so tired of lecturing by April that I'm ready for the phones to start ringing. But, it's always new stuff that comes in. In fact, I had been out of the office for a while, and it's going to take me a while to catch up. You would not think there would be that many specimens, but people do find things to send me at this time of the year. So,
well, Phil, it's always a pleasure. Look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
It's always a pleasure, isn't it? Phil Pelletieri, University of Wisconsin Extension entomologist. He heads up the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And if you go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, we've got a link to that lab address, and you can go right to it. He's got lots of wonderful information and some great photography, great photos of insects on that site. Just to take a look at what's coming up tomorrow, Chad Spade, a carpenter and contractor, and architect Andrew Brayman Wanek, they will be with us to share some current trends in home construction and design and to answer your home improvement questions as well. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.